Support for this podcast is provided by the University of California Irvine School of Law Graduate Tax Program. The Graduate Tax Program at the UC Irvine School of Law is the number one ranked graduate tax program on the West Coast and number five ranked program nationally. It offers a unique curriculum that gives students a chance to develop both deep knowledge and the practical skills needed to practice law both here in the U.S. and around the world. It's a one-year, full-time program held at the UC Irvine campus. Applications are open now. The deadline to apply for non-U.S. applicants is February 1st, 2022. U.S. and U.S.-based international applicants must apply by July 1st, 2022. To apply today, visit law.uci.edu/gradtax. That's law.uci.edu/gradtax.
Welcome to Tax Notes Talk, a podcast from Tax Notes, the leading source of tax news, information, and analysis.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm David Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of Tax Notes Today International. This week, State Status Report. As the year is coming to a close, we're taking a look at how states here in the U.S. altered their tax policies in response to the second year of the pandemic, as well as what might be key issues in 2022. Tax Notes senior reporter Paul Jones recently spoke with Carl Davis, research director with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Paul, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, David. It's always a pleasure.
So could you tell us a bit about what you and Carl spoke about?
Sure. We spoke about states that pursued tax cuts in light of budget surpluses in 2021, as well as some that have moved to make more progressive tax reforms. We also discussed some tax policy debates he anticipates will be part of states' 2022 sessions, including responses to the potential passage of the Build Back Better package and taxation of digital services and cannabis.
All right, let's go to that interview.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with one of the most obvious developments. Due to the pandemic, there were a number of states that were obviously concerned that in light of the lockdowns, their revenue was going to suffer. But as it subsequently turned out, a lot of states actually enjoyed very healthy revenues and even surplus revenues. And there have been some that have actually debated cutting or actually enacted tax cuts. Can you talk about that trend and what's behind it and whether you think it's going to continue in the 2022 session? And I'm also curious if you think it's prudent for states to react to these near-term surpluses by making long-term changes to their tax base.
Right, yeah. So the situation with state budgets really has been remarkable. I mean, it's not difficult at all to imagine a situation where states were needing to make drastic budget cuts more in line with what we saw during other recessions, and budget cuts that would have really, in a lot of ways, compounded the hardships that we saw during the pandemic. And instead, what we saw was the federal government intervene with a very robust policy response, thinking here not just about direct aid to states and localities, but the economic impact payments and the enhanced unemployment benefits. What things like those did was raise incomes, raise sales for purposes of the sales tax, and you ended up with a stronger economy than almost anyone expected because of that. And how states responded to that impact on their budget outlook, it's varied quite a bit. You know, a lot of states have used the money to strengthen their school systems or their infrastructure or public health programs, which we, you know, clearly see a strong need for now. But we're also, seeing these examples, like you said, of states cutting taxes, not really the sales tax as much. We haven't seen sales tax cuts. It's been mostly on the income tax side in terms of the larger tax cuts. And with the income tax, the question is, who's going to get those tax cuts? Because you really have the ability to fine-tune an income tax cut to go to families at any given point on the income scale, or to do it broadly. And states have really taken very divergent approaches here. So in a state like Washington State or Maryland or Connecticut, the priority in their tax cutting was really for lower income workers and raising their standard of living through, say, a larger earned income tax credit. Colorado, they did that as well. But there was also the funding of a child tax credit that extends higher up the income scale, not just to low-income workers, but to middle-income families as well. And then you also have states that, you know, very clearly prioritize tax cuts for their most affluent families. So states coming to mind here would be New Hampshire, Arizona, Ohio, there are others. You know, typically those tax cuts are being marketed as a means of economic development. Think of it as, you know, the modern day trickle down theory, tax cuts at the top, finding their way to everyone else. You know, I worry about that approach in particular. I don't know that the evidence bears that out, that at the state level, that kind of tax cutting is going to have a meaningful positive impact on state growth. I think what we're going to see in a lot of cases over the long run, you know, responding to the situation you mentioned, this rosy budget picture isn't going to last forever. But in a lot of cases, these tax cuts are written to last forever. And so you can end up with this, you know, a situation where there are fewer resources to put into, you know, shrinking class sizes, expanding healthcare access, any other service. And instead, what you might see is more upward pressure on regressive tax sources. States turning to things like, you know, higher sales taxes, higher excise taxes to pick up the slack long run that's been created by these tax cuts. And what we tend to see when that happens is a shift toward more regressive state taxation in general. We have a report called Who Pays that looks at the distribution of taxes by income level. And we find that states generally are taxing in a somewhat regressive fashion. And I think the income tax cuts we've seen in some states have the potential to make that worse, especially over the long haul.
Right. And I know that there were also a couple of states that were actually at least discussing eliminating their income tax. I think Mississippi was one, and I believe the governor actually recently resurrected a proposal to get rid of that state's income tax. Do you think we're going to see more states move in that direction? Do you think those proposals are likely to advance next year, or is that a bridge too far?
Yeah, you know, for the last decade, I think we've seen a state or two debate this almost every year, maybe every other year. It's really a tough thing to pull off in practice. Well, for one thing, states have balanced budget requirements. So if you're going to outright eliminate one of your major sources of revenue, the cuts that you have to make to public services, to public institutions to make that happen, they have a large human toll. And broadly, I mean, they create a lot of economic concerns as well. And what we saw in Mississippi was the business community was not particularly enthusiastic about the income tax elimination plan. In some instances, there seemed to be outright hostility to it when they were looking down the road and saying, well, what's this going to mean for our infrastructure? And what's this going to mean for our higher education system or, you know, ability to attract highly skilled employees? So the only state that ever actually managed to pull off repeal of a broad income tax was Alaska. You know, they did it only after it became apparent they were sitting on enormous amounts of oil that could be used to fund their budget. So very different situation than Mississippi or, say, West Virginia finds itself in right now. You know, in Mississippi, the current proposal from the governor, as I understand it, would not even offer any replacement revenue. A lot of times an income tax elimination plan might be paired with, say, a higher sales tax. You know, you could call that, may not, for a lot of families, they may not even experience that as a tax cut on net. Typically, what you know, if you have a lot of income, you'll probably get a large income tax cut. If you tend to have a more moderate income, you know, your higher sales tax bill could very easily offset whatever income tax cut you might get. So it ends up being more of a tax shift than a tax cut. Well, in Mississippi, what they're talking about now is not replacing the revenue, not raising sales taxes, not doing anything like that. And, you know, I think to make that work, you're going to have to see really staggering budget cuts that I think would be extremely difficult to navigate through the legislature. One way they might try to deal with it is with a very slow phase-in of income tax repeal, maybe triggered, maybe not. You know, what that would allow the legislature to do is really put off all the hard decisions until later, you know, maybe much, much later when the current crop of lawmakers aren't even in office anymore. You know, I view that kind of approach, these long phase-ins, as really a gimmick because it amounts to lawmakers sidestepping the central question in every tax and budget debate, which is around prioritization. You know, if you do more of this, what are you going to do less of? In this case, there's going to be more income tax cuts and less of, we don't know, because we're going to put that decision off for years or decades. So you know, I think to make the math work, we may see them headed in a direction like that. I don't consider it a prudent policy course, and how it fares might depend on how the business community reacts to that kind of plan. But that may be where things are headed. And generally, yeah, I do think we're going to be headed into another year where tax cutting, maybe shy of outright income tax elimination, but where tax cutting is talked about in a lot of states. And what remains to be seen is who's going to benefit from those tax cuts? How are they going to be designed? And particularly at different points in the income scale, where will those tax cuts be targeted?
Right. And it sounds like, as you noted in your first answer, there are some states that are looking at cutting taxes specifically on lower income earners, and that might be seen as sort of more of a progressive reform as opposed to the other approach where you have states cutting taxes with an eye towards reducing the tax burden, maybe across the board, but particularly on higher earners. We should note that there were some states that actually moved sort of in the opposite direction and looked at trying to make their tax codes more progressive. States like Washington, which established a new capital gains tax, New York and Colorado, and I believe also the District of Columbia. Looking at that, you know, what are some of the policy considerations that states should be considering when they're moving in that direction? And do you think there are going to be some states that sort of continue to push to improve the progressivity of their state tax regimes?
Yeah, I do think this is going to continue to be a major item of debate. You know, in the last several years, there's been a big boost in awareness around issues of inequality, both inequality in income and in wealth. We have enormous gaps by both those measures, economic inequality and racial inequality in particular. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, those gaps seem to be solidifying, or you can even find instances of them worsening. And I think that concern has animated the federal tax debate in a huge way. And it's been a big part of the debate over the last several months. At the federal level, it's been a point of debate in the states even longer than that. You know, in a state like Washington, what was really critical there was an acknowledgement that their existing tax system is overwhelmingly regressive. You know, they're raising money mostly through sales taxes, through gross receipts taxes. It's pretty clear cut. Those are regressive taxes that hit lower income families hardest. And so the Washington approach was to try to diversify away from those revenue sources, bring in some progressive options as well. And capital gains certainly represents a progressive option. It's capital gains are overwhelmingly enjoyed by higher income families. And so it's a way to add a little bit of progressivity into the mix, into what is still a regressive tax code in Washington. You know, I think as we're seeing inequality rise over time, I think we're going to keep seeing an interest on this topic and in making sure that, you know, the people who are faring best and are enjoying a lot of success are chipping in to pay for the public services, the public institutions that really, you know, allow society to function and that have created an environment where they can amass what are in some cases just huge fortunes. There's really a practical concern here for state budgets as well. And that's if we see people at the top continuously growing their share of income, their share of wealth, you know, taxing those families then becomes a really powerful and essential part of keeping state budgets funded. You know, it makes less and less sense over time to rely on regressive taxes on the poor and middle class when you see most money flowing to people at the top. That's where bulk of new income growth is going. And so, you know, the really dramatic example we saw in the last year or two of this is California. In California, the state budget fared quite a bit better than expected, in large part because the state does have a progressive income tax, and it positioned it to capitalize on the fact that wealthy families in the state fared extraordinarily well during this, you know, this bull market run-up we've seen, especially since March of 2020. In times of widening income inequality, progressive taxation becomes even more of a potent revenue-raising tool. And I think California demonstrates that. And I think, you know, if inequality continues on its current trajectory, then I don't think this aspect of the debate is going to go away. You know, one place I know where it's going to get attention next year is Massachusetts. Voters are going to have a chance in, you know, about a year from now in November of 2022 to decide whether they want to add a second tier onto their flat tax, a higher tax rate for millionaires in particular. Outside of Massachusetts, I'm not aware of any more proposals like that that are already guaranteed to be on the ballot, but I'm sure we're going to see this debate happen in other states as well.
Right. And I know even in California, there has been talk of, for example, a wealth tax. I believe there was talk of a wealth tax in Washington as well. So that federal debate over inequality and new ways of taxing higher earners seems to be influencing at least discussions at the state level. One thing I should also note is that progressive taxes, particularly if they tax gains in the stock market, can be somewhat volatile. Is it important for states that decide to move in that direction to make sure that they have a good fiscal plan for sort of reaping the benefits of that type of taxation during the boom years and making sure that they don't lose sort of that revenue base if the stock market declines for a period of time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, rainy day funds are an essential part of state budgeting. I think, you know, that volatility, capital gains can be volatile. You know, the most volatility tends to be in the energy dependent states like Wyoming or Alaska. So there, you know, there's volatility is something we see in a lot of states, and it's something that can be managed through good budgeting practices. You know, another thing that on capital gains in particular, there are proposals at the federal level right now that would raise the overall tax rate on extremely high income families, say incomes over 10 million or incomes over 25 million a year. A higher rate on those families is largely going to be impacting capital gains. And so one thing we're seeing the JCT forecast, for example, is that we're going to likely see some acceleration of capital gains income into the last few weeks of this year among high income families that want to sell their stock before those higher rates take effect. So that could be another thing we see with capital gains trends. We might see a little bit of a run up in capital gains realizations in this last month of the year. And, you know, that could have the effect of making state budgets in some places look even rosier. But the thing to realize then is this is really a timing issue. And so if we see capital gains, you know, spike over the last several weeks of this year, well, then they're going to come down after that for a little while. And we may see depressed capital gains revenue, especially among very high income families, you know, throughout the rest of 2022. So I think it's going to be important not to take, you know, not to view what's happening with capital gains over these next several weeks as the indication of a long run trend, because we might be in for a little bit of a rocky road ahead on that income source in particular. Not a reason not to tax it, but you have to be prepared for that volatility and understand what's driving it.
Support for this podcast is provided by SafeSend. When the whole world is short-staffed, it's more important than ever to assess current firm processes and make improvements. How can you do more with less? Invest in an automation solution that will save your admin staff hours on assembly, delivery, and e-signing of tax packages. SafeSend Returns automates the last mile of tax engagement, saving your firm valuable time and making staff happier. Schedule a demo to experience this automation solution for yourself at safesend.com. That's safesend.com.
So let's look at another area of activity by states that we're probably going to see more focus on in the coming year, and that has to do with conformity. Obviously, there was a lot of conformity legislation adopted by states that were directly addressing the CARES Act and the Consolidated Appropriations Act, either conforming to various provisions or decoupling from them. But now there's the potential for the passage of the Build Back Better package that is supported by the Biden administration. And if that is approved in something resembling its current form, how do you think that's going to impact states' conformity considerations? I think you and I had previously talked about how that could affect the state's decisions to conform to corporate income tax provisions, excess business losses, GILTI, and potentially even the SALT cap, obviously.
Right. Yeah. There are some significant conformity issues here. Fewer than there could have been, though. I mean, if we had seen a serious effort at repealing stepped up basis, for example, that would have presented conformity questions for states. But still, I mean, yeah, there are definite implications for state tax codes here. I mean, one thing, of course, is improved tax enforcement would be part of the Build Back Better plan. And that could pay off for states over the long run. If we see the tax gap shrink, that could benefit state income tax revenues as well. I think that's a ways off, but that's something to have in mind. On the corporate income tax, there's talk of strengthening the anti-abuse rules administered through the GILTI regime. It's meant to deal with shifting of profits into lower tax jurisdictions. That could bolster corporate revenues a bit in the 20 or so states that are taxing GILTI now. And it could offer an extra inducement for other states to begin taxing that income as well, because they would effectively be leaving more money on the table if they continue not to tax guilty, which was, you know, initially part of the 2017 tax law. So at this point, it's going to become a bipartisan provision, initially enacted by Republicans and then strengthened by Democrats. Otherwise, you know, pass-through businesses, more important issue is around the limit on excess business losses. Again, this is another feature of the 2017 tax law initially. It was included to stop temporarily, to stop pass-through businesses from using large business losses to offset other forms of income. You know, under the CARES Act, in response to the pandemic, that limitation was lifted for 3 years. But the legislation working through Congress now would finally allow that to take effect and actually make it permanent, I believe. So, you know, states might find that to be an appealing item to conform to in the places where that hasn't already happened. SALT cap, you know, I think what we're likely to see is some kind of loosening of the cap. It seems like outright repeal is now off the table. Congress could choose to loosen it either by raising the dollar amount, taking it from, say, 10 grand up to 80,000. Or they might decide just to lift the cap for certain families, you know, say families below 400,000 of income or maybe a level higher than that. From a strictly conformity perspective, that's relevant in 20 states or so that have an itemized deduction for property taxes, or maybe even an itemized deduction for sales taxes or income taxes. So that's a little more rare. But 20 states or so have those deductions in a way where they've chosen to cap it at the same 10,000. As the federal level. And so if Congress decides to loosen that $10,000 cap, these states are going to need to decide whether they want to loosen it right along with Congress and take the revenue hit involved in that, or whether they want to keep the stricter $10,000 limit in place. So I'm thinking we'll see debates over that as well.
Yeah. And actually, to go back and tie this back a bit with our earlier discussion about some of the tax reforms that states have been making, based on what's being discussed at the federal level, how might federal legislation impact states' conformity calculus with respect to the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit? Would that potentially offer an opportunity for states to make their tax codes less regressive?
Yeah, definitely. You know, most states right now have an earned income tax credit piggybacked in some way on federal rules. Increasingly, we're seeing states depart from those federal rules in one way or another, but you know the backbone of those credits is still federal policy, and so the federal change would extend for another year enhancements to the EITC for childless workers. The EITC was the credits is far more generous for families with children than for families without children, and so you know creates a little bit of a disparity there. And so for a while this has been a topic of debate of creating more parity between, you know, families of different types, those with and without kids. And that's what the federal proposal would do, at least for another year, offer a larger credit for childless people and you know, extend that credit to families that are currently ineligible, like, you know, childless workers under the age of 25 who are just, you know, trying to get a foothold in the job market, or childless workers over the age of 65. Who can't claim the credit now, but who may be stuck working late into life because they don't have the funds to afford to retire. I think those are pretty, in my opinion, pretty clear-cut improvements to the EITC, just broadening its reach to include populations that have really been left out of the credit. And so states will have to decide whether they want to pick those up in their own credits. A lot of states have actually, I shouldn't say a lot, but some states have started to already make improvements in this area and enhance their own EITCs for childless people. So in some ways, the federal government is playing catch up with a place like the District of Columbia, which has already done something along these lines. But I think states are going to want to decide whether they should do this. I think for simplicity reasons alone, it's probably worthwhile. The EITC can be a bit of a complex credit to claim. And I think, you know, allowing the state credit to mirror federal rules as closely as possible, at least avoids adding additional complexity to that, you know, to that claims process for families who may not have a lot of resources and a lot of ability to access more complex benefits like that. On the child tax credit side, there's less of a, you know, traditional clear-cut conformity question here. Most states don't have child tax credits, and the few that do, it's not even always directly coupled to the federal credit. Sometimes it's a standalone program. But I think the federal CTC has been, it's popular enough, and it's producing results in a lot of ways, really dramatically reducing child poverty by something like half. I mean, this is a transformative change. And I think that, you know, states are going to take notice of that policy shift at the federal level and want to see what they can do to build on that success. So we might be headed in a direction of more states wanting to pursue child tax credits just to because the federal government is showing that it's an approach that can really benefit families, particularly lower income families who are struggling. And then those are the there's just so much evidence around child tax credits and what they can do for kids in vulnerable economic situations who are facing a lot of uncertainty and stress that's just, you know, permeating the household when it's unclear if, you know, the family's going to be able to afford to pay rent or keep food on the table or do any of these things. If you add a little bit of economic stability and economic certainty through something like a child tax credit, it can really have, you know, big benefits for the kids over the long run, creating a more stable environment. It's been tied to better health outcomes, better academic outcomes. And so I think for that reason, too, I think states are going to want to give it a close look. And I'll definitely be watching how state policy evolves on that front next year.
Yeah, that definitely fits in sort of with that larger theme of states looking at how they're going to approach their tax regimes from a standpoint of its impact on lower income people, higher income people, et cetera.
Support for this podcast is provided by the University of California Irvine School of Law Graduate Tax Program. Are you an employer looking to interview some of the best tax talent at the top law schools in the country? If so, then you'll want to check out the Tax Attorney Recruiting Event, or TARE, the largest event of its kind. The event is being held virtually on Thursday, February 24th, 2022, and brings together more than 150 graduate students from the LLM in Taxation programs at Boston University School of Law, the University of Florida Levin College of Law, Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, and University of California Irvine School of Law. Participating employers will have the opportunity to pre-screen applications and select candidates with whom they wish to interview. Employers may participate by interviewing students virtually during TARE, or by collecting resumes from participating students. Don't miss out on this unique opportunity. Go to the-tare.com and click on the employer registration link. That's the-tare.com.
I want to move on into a slightly different direction, and this one has to do with a sort of an issue that's been percolating all year long, which is this idea of taxing digital advertising. And a lot of the news has focused on Maryland's law. That's gotten a lot of attention. Do you think this type of tax, so, you know, we've been discussing how states are looking at maybe taxing higher earners, but this is sort of an idea of taxing a new type of service, or at least taxing that type of service sort of for the first time in its own way. Do you think more states are going to be looking at that? And more importantly, I guess, do you think that more states are actually going to pursue digital taxes on advertising? And if so, what are some of the political and legal obstacles that they're going to have to address and clear?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we'll see more of these taxes enacted this year, but I absolutely think the debate's going to continue. And what we will see is states refining and strengthening their proposals so that they can get at the core problem that's concerning the lawmakers in a way that can withstand legal challenges. So, you know, on the legal front, the most obvious obstacle is the Internet Tax Freedom Act, which prevents states from singling out internet-based services for special taxes that aren't applied broadly to other, you know, comparable services not offered through the internet. So how the Maryland proposal is going to fare on that front is unclear. You know, it's being challenged in the courts now, but regardless of the outcome of the Maryland law, I think there is a path forward on this general issue, probably more along the lines of what we've seen proposed in New York, which isn't even really an advertising tax. It would be more akin to, say, a royalty assessment, and a royalty assessment specifically on data collection in all its forms, digital and otherwise. So there's no targeting of internet-based services. And the rationale here is, you know, the politics here are pretty interesting. We're seeing these proposals come from lawmakers with very different opinions on almost everything. You know, the rationale that I find, you know, most appealing is one that's more in line with what we've seen under severance taxes on natural resources for a very long time. In this case, we're not talking about, you know, the extraction of oil or gas, but we're talking about companies extracting personal information from residents of a state. And then the purpose of a tax like this can be to ensure that the absolutely enormous, you know, profits that are being reaped based on that information, you know, are shared in some way. You know, some amount of them are shared back to the people from whom that information is derived. So I think, you know, I think there is a legal path forward here. And I think there's a genuine issue here of concentration of power and, you know, doing right by people who are seeing their data harvested for these purposes. You know, oftentimes, you know, maybe technically with their consent, where they click yes on an extremely long form that nobody actually reads, but in practice, in ways that people don't have a lot of control over. I mean, honestly. So I think this debate's going to be worth following because I think there's a long run. I think there's real appeal here. I just don't know if we're going to see a state get one of these, you know, other than Maryland. I don't know if we'll see another state get one of these across the finish line next year, but I'm looking forward to the conversation continuing.
Right. And you mentioned the Internet Tax Freedom Act. This conversation is obviously being driven in part by states, but is it going to be necessary ultimately for this to be realized in a really practicable way for there to be federal legislation or reform, for example, to the Internet Tax Freedom Act? And if that's the case, does that create a real serious obstacle to states moving forward or following Maryland's path?
You know, I would like to see the Internet Tax Freedom Act reformed, but I don't think that it's necessary for states. I think states can find a way to tax, say, you know, data collection, which is really more so the core issue than the advertisements that are being served themselves. It's the personalized data that underlies those targeted ads that's more of concern. And I would think if you could apply a levy on data collection generally and not single out, you know, digital based data collection, what it could be in all forms, I don't really see an Internet Tax Freedom Act problem there. So I don't know that states have to wait. And again, I don't even think the outcome of what we see with the challenge to the Maryland law is going to tell us a whole lot about this broader policy area and what's possible for states under, say, a data levy of a different design.
Right. And moving on to our last topic with respect to states not waiting for the federal government to take action first, we did see an increase in the number of states this year that legalized cannabis, with several approving recreational pot this year, including New York. So on that front, a lot of states have sort of created a trend, even though it's still federally banned, they're taking the initiative to legalize it and tax it. I wanted to get your thoughts on this trend, if you think we're going to see more states in the upcoming year follow suit. And also with those states that have legalized marijuana or that are considering legalizing it, do you think that there is a tax structure or model that is likely to work best over time that states that have legalized marijuana should look at reforming their systems to emulate, and that states that are considering legalizing it should adopt from the top?
Yeah, so this started out as really a Western states phenomenon. So Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, California were among the first to legalize cannabis and to tax it. And since then, we've seen it move east. A lot of the East Coast, especially the Northeast, and in parts of the Midwest now have legal cannabis. And I think we're going to see this trend continue around the nation, partly because we have states now like Rhode Island that are just surrounded on all sides by states where cannabis is already legal. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, in my opinion, to ban the sale of something when your residents can just hop over the border and get it right next door and pay tax to your neighboring state instead. So Rhode Island, Maryland, Pennsylvania, several other states are likely to see cannabis legalization and taxes on their ballot in November of 2022. So I think the trend's going to continue. And on the tax front, you know, I think it is a pretty interesting debate. For a long time, the two dueling approaches were to tax the price of cannabis being sold, so like a sales tax that you're used to paying on cars or furniture or anything else, or to do a more traditional excise tax on the quantity being sold, say the number of pounds or the number of ounces of cannabis being sold. You know, that would be more like a motor fuel tax typically, where it's a tax on the number of gallons, or a cigarette tax on the number of packs sold. So you have these two competing approaches. The big difference there, I think, is that if we're headed toward eventual federal legalization, which I think we are, once that happens, we're going to, you know, state borders are going to open up, and we're going to see interstate commerce in this market where it hasn't previously existed. And when that happens, the companies involved are going to be much larger. I think growing of cannabis is going to start to take place more in places where it makes sense from a climate or environmental perspective. Where can you grow it the cheapest on a large scale, particularly for edible products, where that will really lend themselves to large scale farming like that. And, you know, with interstate commerce and larger businesses involved, I think price is going to come down a lot. And, you know, it's compared to other agricultural products right now, cannabis is incredibly expensive. And so if we're going to be on a trajectory of declining prices over time following federal legalization, these states that have chosen to tax exclusively based on price, basically they've hitched up their tax regime to a declining tax base. You know, you might see more quantity being sold over time in the legal market. In fact, you know, I'm sure we will. But the price, if the price is coming down a lot, it's really going to hold down not only revenue growth, but also the deterrence effect of the tax. That's one of the main purposes of levying a special tax just on cannabis. It's to, say, keep it out of the hands of children, for example, and, you know, raise the price enough where children can't afford to easily purchase it. And if you have a tax hitched to price, that deterrent effect is just going to get chipped away over time as the price falls and the tax falls right along with it. So it's automatic tax cuts. We do have states, Alaska, California, Maine, where they include quantity-based taxes in their cannabis tax system to some extent. Sometimes it's paired with a price tax, sometimes not. The new innovation is in New York, where there's a potency-based tax. You know, measure the number of milligrams of THC being sold, THC being the main intoxicant, and tax every milligram, tax the amount of intoxicant being sold. I think that's another form of quantity tax. Instead of weighing out the number of ounces, you're counting up the number of milligrams. So it wouldn't be vulnerable to a price decline if you do it right. And it gets directly at the core issue of, you know, you're levying a special tax on cannabis because it's an intoxicating substance. And that's why, you know, it gets a special, it's called a sin tax, is traditionally what these have been called with alcohol and cigarettes, for example. So I think that New York approach, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out on the ground. I think it's got a lot of theoretical appeal. The main questions have always been around the science and how accurately and easily can you measure THC in different products. And I think that the science has gotten a lot better over time. And I expect that New York is going to be able to pull this off. But it's going to be interesting to have a concrete example, see if this tax type is workable in practice. And if it is, states might want to take a look at that system as something to replace a price-based tax regime that, you know, like I said, is really built on what's going to be a declining tax base as prices collapse.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how this sort of underscores, since the federal government isn't taking initiative with respect to marijuana legalization, how states are having to experiment sort of with their own approaches, both with respect to regulation and obviously with tax policy. And I think that sort of underscores how the state tax policy arena is really an area that people should follow to see sort of how different policy approaches to taxation, whether it's, you know, marijuana taxation, digital advertising, reform of tax regimes in an attempt to maybe encourage business growth or try and reduce regressivity, how states come up with all these different approaches and allow us to sort of see in real time, you know, some of the pros and cons and some of the consequences of the decisions that are made. Carl, it's been really interesting to get your perspective. I know that we'll all be looking at the 2022 session with interest, and hopefully we can reconnect and take stock of what happened maybe in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
And And now, coming attractions. Each week we highlight new and interesting commentary in our magazines. Joining me now is Acquisitions and Engagement Editor-in-Chief Paige Jones. Paige, what will you have for us?
Thanks, Dave. In Tax Notes Federal, Benjamin Allery and Catherine Gardhouse use machine learning models to evaluate the strength of the legal factors that determine the outcome of assignment of income cases. Alan Viard examines the federal tax deduction for state and local business taxes. In Tax Notes State, Rick Handel looks at the interrelationship of Commerce Clause Nexus, Due Process Nexus, and Personal Jurisdiction. Jerron Lammers argues that media analysis and Google Trends data both indicate that public opinion has not been the primary reason why governments have taken legislative action to curb corporate tax avoidance. In Tax Notes International, Nana Amasarfo and Stephanie Song Johnston interview members and observers of the OECD Inclusive Framework to discuss the momentum, creation, and inner workings of the organization, as well as its relationship to developing countries. Alvin Warren Jr. examines the argument of the Oxford International Tax Group that its proposal for a cash flow tax on domestic sales by domestic and foreign corporations is progressive. And finally, in featured analysis, Ben Willis and Ryan Dobins explain why it's unlikely the House version of the Build Back Better Act will succeed in reversing President Biden's earlier efforts to expand the Section 1202 exclusion from 50% to 100%.
That's it for this week. You can follow me online at TaxStew, that's STEW, and be sure to follow at TaxNotes for all things tax. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for a future episode, you can email us at podcast@taxanalyst.org. And as always, if you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating or review wherever you download this podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode of Tax Notes Talk.
Tax Notes Talk is a production of Tax Notes. You can learn more about us by visiting www.taxnotes.com/podcast. When major media wants the straight story, they turn to Tax Notes. Thank you for listening, and join us again for another edition of Tax Notes Talk. Tax Analyst Inc. does not provide tax advice or tax preparation services. Nothing in the podcast constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice. A full disclaimer is included in the transcript.